Mini Schools of Discipleship at SMB. Song of Songs, exploring the divine romance with Peter Ong.
Okay, so just a little very quick summary of what we did last week. We spent a bit of time looking at some general academic themes of the book of the Song of Songs, and we discussed its poetic form, who the authors are, who the characters are, those kind of things. And we looked at, in particular, a particularly poetic form, which is a chiasm, that the poem is written as a chiasm, this sort of in and out shape, and that will become increasingly more important as we do our second evening today. We also looked at some of the interpretations of the Song of Songs, and after exploring sort of, you know, it's a love story, the Jewish ways of seeing it as a story between Israel and God, and all those kind of things, and some of the rabbinic understandings. We then looked at the what has been persistently the main Christian understanding, which is that it is an allegory of the relationship between Christ and his church. And we began to read it with that in focus. And we got about, we got as far as the end of chapter 2. And we were looking in particular, as we went through it, at some of the poetic devices. And we were looking at, in particular, at some of the sexual tension in the poem. Though we sort of have images of the man and the woman lying together. We have lost and then found and then embracing. And images of both his and her body. But we don't seem to have any sex. Well, tonight's your lucky night. You are waiting for the sex scenes. So let's dive in at halfway through chapter 3. And you'll see in the chiasm that this is the start of, this is the second half of the last sort of bit before we get right into the center. And remember what we've just read. We've just read that she goes searching through the city. Where is my beloved? And finally, she finds him and she holds him and she brings him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her who conceived me. And it's the first sort of point in the poem where we get this real sort of the nub of the sexual, you know, I'm bringing him to the place where we have sex. And then suddenly it switches. And we have the second half of chapter 3. He arrives for the wedding. What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter, the palanquin of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh against terror by night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. It's interesting, isn't it? She, in this chapter, talks about going into her mother's bedchamber where she conceived her. And then as she speaks of him, and it's kind of talking about Solomon, she talks about him and his mother. Again, these are poetic devices. These are parallelisms. But let's look at what we have here in this little poem, this new poem. It's a wedding. Out of nowhere, we're in the middle of a wedding. And this is the groom approaching with all his all his entourage. In my last job, my boss married an Indian lady from a Sikh family, and they went out to India to have a wedding. They had a wedding here, went out to India and have a wedding, and he got to ride on an elephant approaching the bride. Said it was the most thrilling and nerve-wracking thing he'd ever done. And he got all dressed up, and everybody, his wife's brother and all the male members of the family were around him, and they were, you know, basically cheering him as he came in. And it was very much, you know, sort of, here comes the groom. We're about to do this. This is exactly the same kind of picture here. Here comes King Solomon, ready to marry his bride. And he comes with all kinds of signs of his authority and his status. He comes with frankincense and myrrh. And we've looked already last week at those, the use of frankincense and myrrh, in particular where the myrrh, when she is talking, is cited between her breasts. He comes in this litter for one. He comes with an army. He comes in force. And if you're thinking of the back end of Revelation, where Jesus turns up with the hordes just before the kind of wedding banquet, as it were, you should be thinking of those things, because this bit in Song of Songs is one place where John is getting that idea from. He comes with this litter made from Lebanese wood. And it's the most expensive wood. So the cedars of Lebanon were the best trees for thousands of miles with which to build anything with. So he comes with the finest that he can. He comes with the cedar. He comes with silver and gold. He comes with purple cloth, which again is a sign of wealth and royal status. And look, go out, O daughters of Zion. The wider others in this poem are called to come and look upon the groom as he comes. And he comes with a crown. He comes with a crown. He is the king. And so we move from the wedding procession, I want to argue to you, into the bedroom. And now we get what is one of the most intimate parts of the poem, but also one of the most theologically important parts of the poem. I'm going to read up to verse 7. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. This is him talking now. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Now, I have to say that if I was to have written a Valentine's card to Gail before we got married with those kind of descriptions, I'm not sure we'd have ended up married. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing. It's interesting, I grew up on the edge of the Peak District and a bit in Austria, both in sheep rearing areas. So I've seen sheep come up from the washing. I've seen sheep giving birth. There's a sight. And a sheep coming up from the washing isn't the most attractive of things, but it's a sign of being purity. But look, this is what's going on in this love song and this description of her beauty. Essentially, he starts at the top and he moves down. And he moves down as he's looking at her. He moves down and he finishes at her breasts. Right? He finishes at her breasts. It's a clear, sexualized parts of her body. And as he does so, he's drawing back some of these themes that we looked at last week. The lilies, the two fawns, twins of a gazelle. So he's using this love imagery again. And then he uses, until the day breathes and the shadows flee. That same sort of almost there but not quite, do not consummate yet kind of language that we used earlier. And then he uses, and you would almost miss this apart from the place where it appears in the poem in the chiastic structure. And that turns it from being almost another verse of adoration to being profoundly theologically significant. He says this, "You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you." He ascribes perfection to her. Well, you know, most lovers think in their moments of besottedness that the one that they are besotted with is perfect. But look again in our structure of the poem. Because right after this verse comes this single verse in the middle, which echoes the inclusio that we looked at right at the start when we started diving into the poem, echoes those first two verses and those last verses. And here it is, the same idea right at the middle of the poem. "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Sena and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards." And it's amazing, isn't it? Because we are right in the middle of her. It's okay that they're leaving to go to PCC. It's not because they're like, "We're about to talk about sex." But we are. We are right in the middle of him basically telling her how amazing she is. And they are in the bedchamber, right? They are ready to do this. And then he says to her, "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride." What's that about? Well, it is the heart of the meaning of this poem. It is the heart of the metaphor, of the allegory, of the way that we are invited to understand what the overarching theme of this is. That this is not just the love song of a man and a woman, of a king and a princess, but this is the love song of God through his Son Jesus Christ to his church. "Come out of the world, come out of sin, and come away with me. And I will take you to a completely different place." And that is the call of Jesus to the church down the year. It is the call of evangelism. Leave your sinful world behind and follow Jesus. Come and follow me. So verse 1 and 2 right at the start of the...
Yeah, because you said it's 50 to 10, but I don't find it echoes, but I can't see it.
Yeah, so what I want to to suggest to you is that it is the center point of the desire of those of the inclusio. So as we said at the start, she wants to go to him and kiss him. At the end, we see that he wants to go to her. And right in the middle, we have that sense of coming and going in the pinnacle of this first consummation, as we're about to see, where we suddenly move from all these lovey-dovey stuff to this weird kind of come from Lebanon. That's what I'm saying. Lebanon is beyond Israel. It's the north, but it's where the Phoenicians were, and it was they were a huge trading culture across the entire Mediterranean, and they absorbed all the cultures that they went to. So this reference to Lebanon is wider than just Beirut or Tyre or Sidon. This is a culture that epitomizes the Mediterranean world, and therefore the world that doesn't recognize who Yahweh is. Hermon is the northernmost peak of Israel. Armana, Senir are mountains in the same part. So it's come out of the pagan world. Come out and be with me. And it makes sense in this reference to the inclusio, which is about coming, desiring. And then we go right back into the love stuff, right? You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. She says, let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. And then he says, I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. This was a Hollywood movie. They'd be lighting up their cigarettes at this point. Right. Anybody not get what's just happened? Great. Okay. Finally, we get there. And again, yeah, absolutely. Someone's waving their papers underneath them to calm themselves down. Absolutely. Were you getting it as I read? Were you getting the euphemisms? I'll explain them to you in a moment because they are really, really there. Finally, we get there. And this is another sign that verse 8 was our lynch, our cornerstone in the chiasm. Because everything up to this point has been foreplay, and now we are in there. And the euphemisms here work in the Hebrew as they work in the English. If your mind is slightly dirty at this point and thinking what the euphemism is, you're probably right. to let me spell it out for you, okay? Because you must understand the graphic nature of this poem to understand that it is saying what you think it is saying to make the point. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Okay? That's referring to the labia this time. Okay? It's referring to her pre-orgasm. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garment is like the fragrance of Lebanon. He is talking about a woman sexually aroused. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. He is going to take her virginity. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates. Pomegranates are signs of fertility with all trees of frankincense. And there's this sense as you read this, a garden locked, well, unlock it and go in. A spring locked, well, unblock it and let it out. Here is her henna and nard. Now, do you remember last week where we first found henna and nard? It was chapter 1, verse 12, when they first met. When they first met. While the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved to me is a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. And now she is all that to him. Myrrh and alloys with all choice spices, a garden fountain, a well of living water. And curiously, I find this fascinating. She has those myrrh and alloys, which before he had, and it's last in the list of the spices that he talks about her. And it is one of the only places in the song where something that was his becomes hers. And we talked, didn't we? Is the writer inspired by God, perhaps not even understanding what he's doing, using the myrrh as a sign of death? Because this is an allegory of Christ and his church. And here, at the moment of consummation, at the point where we are celebrating the union of these two people, the signs of death from him are given to her. He says, awake, blow upon my garden and let its spices flow. She says, let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. He says, I came to my garden. I gathered, I ate, I drank. The others say, eat, drink, be drunk with love. And we have consummated our love here. We finally got there. Well done. Round of applause to the young lovers. Now, I hope that the sex scene itself, and there's a few more to come, is theologically interesting enough in where it's placed in the poem. But as we come, as it were, round the other side of the chiasm, what I want us to start looking at now is how, when we are reading bits of the poem, how they link to the mirrors on the other side. So the link here, and this is sort of section H and H apostrophe, I can't remember what the technical word for that is in the academic sense is, but the other H. Clearly, this is pre and post the sex encounter. This is the foreplay and the actual sex. This is the desire and the consummation. There we go. And now, as we back out of the center of the chiasm, as we look at what's going on, let's also be thinking about how does this mirror with what we read before. So the next two sections I've entitled Fruitless Search and Love Song Under the Banner. And before we even read them, you can see how they mirror. Because the first half of this mirrors the first half of chapter 3, where she goes out to search for her love. And the second half of it, when she talks about being under the banner, as we'll see, is a mirror of the banner he has over him. The litter, the palanquin, as it's called in some of the translations, which is essentially a one-person chair that is lifted up, and it has a canopy over it. So you see how the parallelisms, you see how as the chiasm unwinds itself, the things are being mirrored across this central apex. Let's read on.
Before you do,
yes.
This question, you made this thing about Lebanon, come away from Lebanon, but then when he's describing it back in verse 4, you know, he describes her as being like, your fragrance is like that of Lebanon, and
yeah.
Or like a streaming water.
So I'll just repeat that for the purposes of this, of the recording, which is essentially, I described her as coming out of Lebanon, and then he describes as being something sweet from Lebanon. What's that to do with, right? That's the question. What do you think the answer is?
I mean, you've kind of pitched Lebanon as the secular world mm-hmm. to escape from, and then you're saying, oh, there's some good things coming from Lebanon. Mm. So it could be her.
It's a sign of affection, isn't it?
I think it's interesting. I think what's going on here is that in the metaphor that we're using here, in the allegory, that what the poet is saying is that she, not just that she's made beautiful and perfect by knowing him, but that his making her perfect and describing her perfection draws out of her all that is good of who she is. So in the same way, I think that for us, when we are saved, we don't just become entirely new people. We're new people soteriologically, but Christ is in this process of sanctifying us and making the best of who we are, because even though we are sinners, and in that sense we are totally lost, we are actually made in the image of God, and there are aspects of us which are good, and actually God is looking to sanctify further. I think that's what's going on there, but it's a really interesting point that you're making there, that this language of Lebanon is used at one time as being the thing that you don't want to be, and then is used as well as things that are good. And you know, he's got his litter is made of the cedars of Lebanon, which are good, right? Is this a sign of redeeming everything that is good out of the fallen world? It's interesting. I think what we're exploring here are the major themes of the allegory in the poem. Like all allegories, if you push it just a little bit too far, it probably falls over. Okay. Yes, why are you asking questions? I'll come over here and take a question here.
Last week you said, you know, Solomon is a bit of a strange role model because he had so many wives.
Yes.
So why is Solomon the role model here then?
I think because Solomon is an archetype king. So what we're seeing here is Solomon in his perfection. We're seeing Solomon as the wise one, as the mighty one, as the builder of the empire, as the rich one. And in that, he is a type of Jesus. But yes, in his mass number of wives and turning away to false gods, he is clearly not a type of Jesus. What we're seeing here is Solomon in his perfection used as a poetic device. We discussed last week, is this actually about Solomon? Was it written by Solomon? Who knows? It's almost like, it's not the point. That misunderstands the nature of these kind of texts. Right. Diving into chapter 5. I slept, my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment, how could I put it on? I had bathed my feet, how could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh. There it is again. My fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk and sitting aside beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spice, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. There it is again. His mouth is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies. Now, last week I spoke about what I think is one of the best devotional texts on this, which is Charlie Cleverly's The Song of Songs. And he describes this as the dark night of the soul. He argues, and I think rightly, that this chapter, this poem, this long poem, only makes sense in the sense of a depth of understanding of Christian discipleship. That we meet Jesus, we encounter him, we are enraptured by him, he transforms our life. And then sometimes that is followed straight away, after years, with times of feeling, where has he gone? And we feel abused in the process. We wonder, does he love us? But here in this poem, you'll notice that the woman comes back, even after the abuse of the watchman who last time, helped her to look and find him. Now they abuse her. And even after all this abuse, she still ascribes to him his worth and his merit. And then suddenly there he is again in his garden. So look, this is a mirror of chapter 3, verse 1 to 5. It sits there in the chiasm. It is a much longer bit, but it is still the mirror of that, of those short five verses. He is there at the start, but then he vanishes. The watchmen, as we've said, become enemies, not friends. She is dripping with myrrh. She is covered by his presence, his myrrh that he gives to her, and yet she still cannot find him. And this song of his absence includes, and this is really interesting, includes the only really long, single, unstopped description of him by her. That's really interesting, isn't it? That's fascinating. When she feels abandoned, and yet she has this long description of him. His eyes are like doves, his cheeks are like beds of spice, his lips are lilies dripping liquid myrrh. Makes you think of stuff like Psalm 63, I thirst for you in a dry land. These songs of desperation, where are you, God? These lamentations, what are you doing, God? And yet I will trust in you. And finally, she spies him in his garden. My garden is how he described her a chapter ago. He called her my garden. And there he is all along. If we take the allegory to its next place, there he is all along with her. People write doctorates on this bit of the poem by itself. I do a 10-part sermon series, God help you, on that bit of the poem itself, because I think it is one of the, it explores one of the deepest and most profound aspects of Christian discipleship and spiritual growth, which is, how do I seek God and trust him when he seems to be gone? And the poet places this, inspired by God, right after our first big sex scene, as almost saying to us, this is a key aspect of discipleship, of having a relationship with God through Jesus. That there are times when it will be literally orgasmic, and there are times when it will be like he is nowhere to be seen. But actually, even when he seems nowhere to be seen, he is there, present. I could speak a lot more on that, but let's move on. The next section is from verse 4 to verse 10, and I've called it the love song under the banner, and it is the mirror of the arrival of the bridegroom that we saw at the start. You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins. We've just heard that, didn't we, right in the middle of the sex scene. Not one among them has lost its young. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. There are, you know where this is going, right? There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The only one of her mother. There you are. There's the reference again to the place where she conceived. Pure to her who bore her. Do you see the parallelism there of the language she used? Come to the... come at the end of chapter 3, verse 5, come to the room of my mother where she conceived me. This is a parallelism of that. The only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines also, and they praised her. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? So you've got this idea of the banners, these things above. They were signs, the banners were signs of a loyalty, of belonging in the army. You would have different kinds of banners and you would know where you belonged, and they would be over you. So this is the mirror of the litter with the cover, so you know who is underneath it. When the litter comes with this amazing, with the groom, but it's an amazing gold and silver, you know it's the king. When there's a banner here with somebody underneath it, you know who this person belongs to. It's a really interesting usage here of Jerusalem, because that probably helped us push the date of this poem a little bit later than Solomon. Because the idea of talking about Jerusalem, well, Jerusalem city only, until David captured it, Solomon's father, it wasn't even really a Hebrew city. So the idea of Jerusalem as the perfect place, lovely as Jerusalem, the place with the temple and so on, is sort of, you know, Solomon's temple. It probably points this to being to the poem not being directly from Solomon's time, but from a temple period afterwards, either pre or post exilic. But it makes us think, doesn't it? Because we've been seeing these images that have been picked up in John's revelation. It makes us think of Revelation 21 and the new Jerusalem as a thing of beauty. Verses 8 and 9 here are superlatives. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. These are superlatives. 60, 80, without number, but mine is the only one. And verse 10 is really interesting. Verse 10 is almost words that he puts into her mouth. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? It's a very weird verse. It's a very, very weird verse. And all the way through this, there are echoes of divinity. When we look at something like, for example, Revelation chapter 19, verse 11. Just turn to it and read it for you. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. And these ideas of in verse 10, who is this who comes down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? It almost feels that that's being lifted. Yes.
NIV. Nothing, and nothing about army with banners.
Ah, frightening. In the NIV, in which verse are we looking at here? Verse 10. What does it say in the New International Version?
Majestic as the stars in procession.
Just majestic as the stars in...
The whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Who is this that appears like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, majestic as the stars in procession?
Brilliant. I don't know the answer to that. We can have a quick look at the actual Hebrew word if you wanted to. Probably it's trying to say the same thing here, because the banners would have been up high and the stars are up high. So off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that. That's really interesting. I think what it also does is it points to us that the translational issues of this poem are rather interesting as well. How you choose to convey something in the English. Have you looked it up there?
I am.
I'm using the English Standard Version here.
Interlinear says.
And interlinear says what?
Terrible as an army with banners.
The Amplified's got. So I'm quite close to the Amplified.
And what's the Amplified got? Majestic as an army with banners. Fantastic, thank you very much. So I'm going to suggest that the NIV here is making a poetic, a translational choice here.
The non-inspired version.
The non-inspired version, yeah. Okay. And then we move into what I've got is two verses followed by the dancing Shulamite. Fantastic, the dancing Shulamite. That's like a 50s B movie, isn't it? And these two poems, the small poem and then the big poem, are mirrors of the flowers and trees and then the poem of spring. And if you remember, the poem of spring ended with this longing for intercourse that was never consummated in chapter 2, verse 16. Well, here's her little two verses. I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsman, a prince. This is almost a flashback. Now, interestingly, some translators ascribe this to him rather than her. But I think this makes much better sense as being her saying this. This is verses 11 and 12. Ian's about to tell us who the Amplified Bible ascribes it to.
No, it's described it to her.
Some translators would ascribe this to him, but I think it makes much better sense ascribed to her. Remember, as we said in the first week, the Hebrew text doesn't say him, her, them, so on. It just goes straight through. If it's her, she's raised to the side of the prince as he goes into battle. And remember also how he described her right back in the poem as a mare amongst the Egyptians' chariots, a horse, female horse on heat, driving them wild. If it's him, then it describes him at the head of the army as a forceful warrior. I think this is her. I think it makes sense. It makes sense in terms of the chiasm and the mirror. It makes sense in terms of the textual feel. These are the two most argued over verses in the whole Song of Songs. Just on these two verses, is it him, is it her? Arguments go back and forth. And we move from here into what I'm going to call the dancing Shulamite. Now, before I do that, I just want to take us back a moment, back into her descriptions in, his descriptions. No, sorry, take back to her descriptions back in at the back end of the second half of chapter 5, because this is really interesting and will make sense now. Up to now, when we've had descriptions, we've essentially had from there to there. Right? And often that's been him of her, and he comes down to here and he stays there where the breasts are, and why wouldn't he? But did you notice as we were reading the back end of chapter 5 that as she describes him, she goes through his whole body? It's an interesting poetic shift. Well, now we have what I'll call, as it were, the dancing Shulamite, where he describes her. It begins with the others saying, "Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you." And then he goes on, "Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? How beautiful are your feet in sandals." As we read this, think where he's looking as he goes up. "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bach Rabim. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon which looks towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. O may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine." And we finish with what I think are the two most erotic lines in the entire poem. She says, it goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Now, we'll explain that euphemism at the end, but it is what you think it is. In chapter 5, when she describes his body from top down to bottom, she describes him in the midst of this dark night, in the midst of his absence. And now we have the mirror of that full body description starting at the bottom and going up. So what's really interesting theologically is that these two descriptions are part of the same long sex scene of arousal and final consummation, an act poetically thus. So when we saw her in what the allegory seems to be the dark night of the soul, that is still part of the arousal. It is essential to the erotic nature of the poem, and therefore in this deeper allegory where the consummation, where the orgasm is the height of the union of Christ and his church, it is part of that. It is an essential part of that. We are being drawn into this deeper mystery of discipleship. So look what happens. She went on him from top down to bottom, and now he starts not at her top, but at her feet. And this time he goes all the way up as she is dancing. And she is given this time, interestingly, descriptions of royalty in this physical description. Purple flowing locks, the king held captive, i.e. she is the queen consort. And this all links with the interpretation of those that verse in the chariots being her being next to the prince. And now he comes having gone up. And this is almost like you can imagine this as a sex scene that they're naked and she's gone down him, looking down him, and he's probably gone looked down with her, and then they're coming up together again. And then he goes down again. And he goes down to her breasts, and then it keeps on going down, and she finishes it off. And the euphemism here is exactly what you think it is. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. This is our second sexual encounter in the poem. And now we get this usage of, I am my beloved's and his desire is for me. And remember last week when we talked about the use of those words, we described them not so much as, wait, don't unpack the Christmas presents until it's actually the 25th of December or the evening of the 24th of December if you're a lucky Austrian like me. I think this is a genuine, this now changes the meaning of that. This is, you know, this usage of to do not arouse, I am my our beloved. Here, this is the height of orgasm, and then this just resting in each other. I am my beloved's, and he is mine. And so we've had two sex scenes, and we come to the end of this little mirror of what was happening previously. Let's crack on. We've got two poems here that work together. Back end of chapter 7, start of chapter 8, as the mirror of verse 1, 15 to 17. Remember, that was what we called outdoor love, and it was the first mention of a shared home. Here we are at the back end of chapter 7. This is her talking. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. And then we move on. Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now you see, again, this is the mirror of what we had previously in chapter 1, verses 15 to 17. Remember the themes there. Behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful. Our couch is green, the beams of our house, our cedar, our rafters, our pine. It's also bringing in some of these themes from the vineyard in chapter 1 and the sense of shame and being mistreated by the brothers. And now here we are saying, oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breasts. And at first that seems, well, no, her brothers didn't seem to be very nice. They pushed her out and made her look after the vineyard. And it, you know, and she got dark and dirty. But this is almost redemptive language. This is almost going back to what she experienced and redeeming it all. What if it could be as though her brothers were kind to her? What if it could be as though the vineyard, see what it says in verse 12, let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. What if the vineyards that made me dark and dirty, what if actually they were beautiful and bore fruit? And as we come right back out of the chiasm here, and we mirror these sort of previous ideas, it takes them and changes them and redeems them and makes them perfect. We've taken the fallen and the broken, and we've sanctified it somehow. And this time, we got, you know, my mother's house. It's an idea using Galatians 4. Are we almost here in sort of heaven as a feel? Verses 3 and 4 are repeating chapter 2, verse 6. Remember when she was laid in his arms? We've got exactly the same image here. We end up with that phrase, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. But this time, let's if we go back to verse 6 in chapter 2, his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. What have we lost? The gazelles and the does. Where are they? Did they run away a long time ago because of the sex scenes? Well, the gazelle and the doe are iconic for male and female in this Semitic culture. So some argue that this is further evidence that we are in the allegory, we are in heaven here, where we are now not really, we are not anymore husband-wife, we just are Christ and his church. And the sexual dimensions have gone. Remember, Jesus said, you know, in answer to the trick question about, you know, woman whose husband dies and then the brother marries and then the next one dies and blah, 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 who will she be married to in heaven? And Jesus goes, yeah, do you not know, we are not given in marriage in heaven. So this is the idea that the allegory is almost completed here now. We have arrived at the end point. We've lost the sexual distinctions which were necessary in this allegory, which made the icon of Christ and his church. We've lost them now because we have arrived at the final destination. Is this when we now use do not awaken, is it because, again, this isn't like a don't unwrap your presence? Is this because you can't get to the final destination until you get there? That you need to go through whatever Jesus brings to you in this life, whether it's close orgasmic intimacy or the desolation, which is actually part of the union as well. And it almost feels at this point in the poem that the allegory is the only thing that makes sense of this poem at this point. But we still haven't got right back to the other end. Verses 5-7. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. There's that imagery again. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is stronger as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. Who is this coming up? In chapter 3, verse 6, this preceded the approach of the groom and then the consummation of the marriage. And now these words are used before a much deeper contentment. You know, these verses 6 and 7, they don't feel erotic in that sort of sexual sense, do they? They speak of this much deeper union. And again, this is linking into the allegory that the act of sex itself is part of the allegory of the union of Christ and his church. And once Christ and his church, once we are together in heaven, the allegory, the metaphor, the icon is no longer needed. We simply are with Jesus. Set me as a seal. And look, if this is the allegory, then what the poem is saying is this: Christ's love is stronger than death. Christ is jealous for us, his bride. Christ is the fire. And look, did you see it? Did you see it in verse 6? What's the first appearance in verse 6? The first time this word appears. At least I hope it does in the new international version. Right at the end. Read me the last line. Of verse 6. Okay. Got no reference to God there, have you? Again, the NIV fails you here. Fails you. The flame of the Lord. Exactly. And the Lord here is in capitalized because it's the holy name of God, Yahweh, the tetragrammatron. I am who I am. There's a footnote. Fantastic. The NIV has a footnote. This is the tetragrammatron, right? The NIV is really poor on the Song of Songs. It really is. Did any of you miss? Sorry? Like the very flame of the Lord. Did any of you miss him up to now? Did you miss the explicit reference towards God? It's not quite as bad as Esther, where God never gets mentioned, though he is there all the time, and you know, there's a reference of, you know, go and pray for, but he just doesn't say who to pray to. Again, if this is the allegory, if we are now in heaven, here we are in the presence of the Lord. This is where we are. We are in God's presence now. That's why he's now here in the poem. It's fascinating stuff. We still haven't got to the end of the poem. We still haven't got to the end of the mirroring. And notice, she is sealed to him. And where is she marked? Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal on your arm. Are these the marks of the cross? I don't know. Their love, sorry? Could be. Their love cannot be quenched. It cannot be bought. Indeed, trying to buy it is despicable. Makes us think of Isaiah chapter 42, verse 3. Let me read that to you. If I can just find it properly. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. These wounds. And he finishes with, under the apple tree, I awakened you. Doesn't finish. So he starts this poem, under the apple tree, I awakened you. And we're right back to this theme of the apple tree being mirrored here as well. And as we said last week, this idea of Jesus Christ, the apple tree, picked up in this medieval poetry. Let's quickly get to the end here. The penultimate one, the C dash. Dash, that's what I was looking for. We have a little sister and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then I was in his eyes as one who finds peace. And we jump back in time now. We jump back in time before she was pubescent. And the wall and the door, the sexual allusions to genitalia. The wall is chastity, the door is promiscuity. And she says, you don't need to protect my entry points. I am chaste and I am waiting. I am a virgin. Actually, are we back in pubescence? Are we still in heaven? Verses 11 and 12, Solomon had a vineyard. Because this stuff at the end of the poem, it's like, what happened to the horny stuff? Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to two keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000 and the keepers of the fruit 200. Remember, the first vineyard that we met in the poem belonged to the brothers. But this is her vineyard. It belongs to Solomon. The vineyard is his, yet is also hers, and she gives it freely to him. And finally, I want to argue, we get back to this closing inclusio. O you who dwell in the gardens and with companions listening for your voice, let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spice. Listening for your voice, calling. The theme at the start, it's the theme at the end. In the middle, he calls, come out. He calls her. Christ calls his church. Make haste is what she responds. Or as the New Testament would say, Maranatha. Come, Lord Jesus. Next week, we haven't gone through this too fast. Next week, what we're going to do is, having got this allegory potentially far too dangerously in our minds, we're going to go right back to the start of the Bible, and we're going to see how the idea of a man and a woman as husband and wife in sexual union, as the icon of Jesus and his church, is actually, to use a word, rampant through Scripture, and is actually the meta-narrative, the overarching story of the Bible. And that is why, as we read in our first session, as you got in your notes, Jerome argued that you only teach this book when you've got the rest of your theology in place. Let me close. Actually, I've got a time for just a question or two at the end, otherwise I'm going to close by reading that medieval poem, Jesus Christ, the Apple Tree. Okay. Perhaps let's just take a moment in quiet. There's been quite a lot of stuff there. Some of it, I hope, quite powerful. I pray that just one or two ideas are sticking with you, that you're going to take them home and mull over them, that you'll be viewing the Song of Songs as this beautiful capstone of the theology of Jesus in the Bible. Jesus Christ, the apple tree. The tree of life my soul hath seen, laden with fruit and always green. The trees of nature fruitless be, compared with Christ, the apple tree. His beauty doth all things excel, by faith I know, but ne'er can tell, the glory which I now can see, in Jesus Christ, the apple tree. For happiness I long have sought, and pleasure dearly I have bought, I missed of all, but now I see, 'tis found in Christ, the apple tree. I'm weary with my former toil. Here I will sit and rest a while, under the shadow I will be of Jesus Christ, the apple tree. This fruit doth make my soul to thrive. It keeps my dying faith alive, which makes my soul in haste to be with Jesus Christ, the apple tree. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you that you call us through your Son to be with you. Thank you that you call us to be with you for eternity. Thank you, Lord, that you have given us a bridegroom who is powerful and strong and loving and gracious and a warrior and a lover. Lord, as we explore the depths of this poem, as we take it away, as we read it again, as we see new things, help us to see how you have made the heart of our sexual being to speak of you. That you use marriage and sex as an image of union with you. And Lord, let us not run away from that, but let us embrace that image and discover its depths. Lord, we want union with you. Lord, in those times of life when we feel you absent and you are gone, when we wonder where you are, if you loved us, when we experience so much but now we have nothing, Lord, bring us out the other end so that we may see that even that point of darkness and emptiness and having lost you, that actually you were there all the time, and that was part of our embrace of you and our encounter and our union with you. Lord, thank you that you call us. You call us to be your own. Lord, will you be with us this evening and this week? And Lord, will you help us to help others to hear your call and to enter into that union with you that has its final resting place in your presence for all eternity. And we ask all these things through the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, who is our great lover, who smothers us with his myrrh and his frankincense. And it is a beautiful thing. In his precious name we pray. Amen.